Hey y'all, I'm Carrie, and this is Monstrous.
So we're back. Mike is with us.
Hi guys. We're back. Back in black.
And to kick off our return, we're going to do another unsolved case. And just like our last Sunday episode, it is a cold case.
Burr.
So this week's case is a missing persons case that involves not one, but two missing people. It is a case with no answers and no evidence.
Fishy.
On November 17th, 1996, the local police department in Bismarck, North Dakota, found a car sitting in a parking lot along the river. The doors were open, key in the ignition, and a purse sitting on the seat. Recent snowfall meant no shoe prints pointing to the driver's direction, and the efforts to locate them at the scene had no results. This is a missing persons case that has haunted the Bismarck Police Department for decades and will continue to do so until it is solved. I'm going to tell you about the disappearance of Sandra and John Jacobson.
Hold on to your seatbelts.
So Sandra Mae Jacobson, also known as Sandy, was born on December 8th of 1959. She worked for the North Dakota Department of Transportation. She was 36 years old. She was a mother of two boys, 5-year-old John and 16-year-old Spencer. John Henry Jacobson was born August 12, 1991. He was said to have been a typical 5-year-old boy. So Sandra had been married twice to Vernon Nastrom, who was the father of Spencer. That marriage ended in divorce, and then to Alan Jacobson, who was her current husband and the father of John. The two were separated at the time of Sandra and John's disappearance.
Okay.
After Sandra and Alan had separated, she bought and moved into a trailer big enough for herself and her two sons in Center, North Dakota, which is a rural city in Oliver County. On the evening of November 16th, 1996, Sandra and John were supposed to go visit Sandra's parents for dinner in Bismarck. On their way to her parents' home, Sandra had made a call to the Bismarck Police Department reporting that she believed there was satanic ritual abuse taking place on a farm near Center and that a loved one was in danger. She was asked why she didn't call her local police department. She stated that she didn't trust either the Center police or the Oliver County Sheriff. The dispatcher she spoke with stated that she was very upset on this call. Sandra was told at the time that because it was out of the Bismarck jurisdiction, there was nothing they could do and she would have to contact the Center police or her county sheriff. So Sandra and John had arrived at her parents' home at around 7:30 p.m. on November 16th, 1996. While at her parents' house, Sandra's mother, Bernice, had felt that her daughter was displaying signs of mental distress, which she had a history of mental health problems. Her mother had urged her to go to the local hospital and receive help, to which Sandra had agreed, but said she first needed to fill her car up with gas. Sandra and John were last seen leaving her parents' home around 8 p.m. with the promise to return after she got gas at the nearby gas station. When Sandra and John hadn't returned by 10 p.m., Bernice got worried and reported both her daughter and her grandson missing. The following day, November 17, 1996, police found Sandra's 1990 Honda Civic abandoned at the Centennial Beach parking lot in Bismarck. The location her car was found at is located across from the Missouri River. The driver's side door was open, the key was still in the ignition, and her purse was on the front passenger seat. The only thing missing was her driver's license. The open door of Sandra's car, paired with the high winds and freezing temperatures on the night of November 16th, had told police and investigators that something was not right, and they were correct. Detective Tim Turnbill was the lead on the case. After reading the missing persons report and learning of Sandra's mental health issues, he believed she had simply lost it, went down a dark path, and that path ended with her and her son both in the Missouri River.
No good.
So somehow, even though her driver's license is missing,
but her purse is still there,
he comes to the conclusion that she threw herself and her five-year-old son into the frozen river.
Yeah, people just do that nowadays.
Yeah, it doesn't really make any sense. Why would she leave everything but her driver's license?
Weird.
What, did she need to take her driver's license into the fucking river?
Yeah. Driving the river. Yeah, you gotta have a license to drive in the river.
It doesn't make any sense. So right away, Turnbill called the Burley County Sheriff's Office and told them to search the water. Because no foul play was suspected, no fingerprints were ever taken from inside the vehicle.
Because they couldn't, or what?
No, just because they, as soon as they read the missing persons report and seen that Sandra had struggled with her mental health, they automatically believed that she had lost her fucking mind and threw herself and her son into the river. That was the belief. So because of that, and there was no sign of foul play, they didn't believe that they needed to take fingerprints or really do any kind of forensic investigating inside the car itself.
Okay.
Even though there was no proof that she did that either. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Nope.
So the Burley County Sheriff's Dive, Rescue, and Recovery Team had conducted a search of the river. It went from between the Centennial Beach and the Railroad Bridge. But because of the current and the amount of ice that was in the water, they weren't able to search it as thoroughly as they wanted to. So if there was so much ice in the water that they couldn't search it completely, how would she have been able to throw herself and her son into it?
I don't know. Things are possible, though.
It just doesn't make sense to me. So because the scene that was left behind for the police to find, it was believed that Sandra, like I said, had killed her son and then herself by jumping into the river. But there's no evidence to prove that. And as far as I could find, there has never been evidence to prove that. So Sandra's 1990 Honda Civic was taken to the Bismarck Police Department for processing the day that it was found. They had rifled through it, obviously, so investigators had found a receipt while just rifling through the car. That's rifling? Yeah, like looking through it, just kind of,
okay,
you know, pulling shit out and looking at stuff. They didn't go through it like with a fine tooth comb. They didn't take fingerprints or try to get fibers or like anything like that out of it. They just kind of looked through the glove box and, you know, all that. So they had found a receipt that was inside her car that showed she did stop at that nearby gas station for gas. So she did what she said she was going to do, but she didn't return back to her parents' house like she was supposed to. So the night Sandra and her son disappeared, there was a lot of snowfall. And because of this snowfall, there were no tracks that led to the river or anywhere else. There was nothing showing, oh, they went to the river, so that's where they had to have ended up. There was none showing they got into another car, no tire tracks, nothing.
Turned into a helicopter and took straight off.
There was no note left behind, no explanation to why she would have harmed herself or her son. So it was really hard for her family to accept that the investigators had believed this on early on in the case. It's just not something that they could fathom. So, on November 18th, 1996, Turnbill met with Sandra's estranged husband, Alan Jacobson, who had just gotten in on a flight returning home from a business trip in Missouri. He had been contacted and informed the day before that his wife and son were missing. But what Turnbill didn't know at the time was the fact that there had been some trouble in the Jacobson marriage, and the two were actually separated at the time of the disappearance. And according to friends and family, Sandra believed they were just days away from a divorce, a process that her husband, Alan, was handling. But upon investigating this, there was no evidence that an initiation of a divorce process had ever been filed. Nor did Alan Jacobson ever mention divorce to the investigators. So
I have no idea.
No, so to Sandra, he was handling the divorce and believed that in a few days, their divorce would be final and that would be it. But no, Alan never initiated that divorce process.
Huh.
Alan had told Turnbill that the two were separated. He told him that he had recently been having trouble with his wife and the two now lived apart. He claimed that this was fueled by Sandra's conspiracy theories that he was having an affair. And according to police files, Alan claimed that these allegations were, quote, totally off the wall. Yeah. Alan then went on to paint Sandra as an unstable woman with periodic religious obsessions. He said during a visit to his home the week before she disappeared, his wife appeared glossy-eyed. He said that during that visit, she got real excited over something and she was shaking when she got up to leave. He said he grabbed her, sat her down, and stayed with her until she was calm. Sounds like a bunch of bullshit to me. But that's just me. Alan told investigators that Sandra had called him about 6:15 the morning of November 16th and told him to pray for their son. She asked him specifically to say the Lord's Prayer for him.
That's suspicious right there.
But was that call truly made?
I don't know. Probably not.
And if she did call him at that time, is that what she really said to him?
Nobody knows.
It's just going based off of his word. So according to Alan, he had left for his trip the morning of November 16th and returned the 18th just before meeting with the detectives. This was apparently enough for Turnbill to say that Alan had no involvement.
Oh.
So he simply told him, oh, I was out of town on a business trip. Turnbill's like, oh, okay. There's no way you did it then.
Just because he was out of town.
And he didn't, like, he didn't contact anybody. He didn't double check and make sure he was actually out of town. Nothing. He completely took his word. Alan told him, I was out of town for a business trip. I left this day and I got back this day. And Turnbill was like, oh, okay. Good for me. But for Turnbill's superiors, it wasn't enough. According to Sandra's loved ones, a close family member had received a call the day they went missing. And that they had believed a third person was in the car. This was relayed to the investigators on November 26th. On December 30th of 1996, Turnbill met with Lieutenant Myron Heinley and Sergeant Nick Servart about the case. Those are Turnbill's superiors. They had concerns about Alan's alibi. That day, Turnbill had spoke to Alan again following his meeting with the Turnbill superiors to discuss the details of his work trip. Documents in the police file say that Alan stated he had left North Dakota on Saturday, November 16th, around 8 a.m. and rode with six other people in a van to Missouri. He said they got to the hotel on the following day, Sunday the 17th. Okay, which I'm going to say, that's not right. Okay. I mapped it, right? Because it didn't make sense to me. I mapped it. Missouri is about 9 to 10 hours away from North Dakota, depending on exactly which town you're going to. But it's about 9 to 10 hours away.
Okay.
Okay? So, if you leave North Dakota for Missouri on around 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning, you should then arrive in Missouri around 6 p.m. the same day, not the following day.
What if you have a detour?
Because 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., that's 12 hours. That's 2 extra hours. state line to state line is about 9 hours.
All right, we got to stop the gas and all kinds of things like that.
Okay, so 12 hours. That still would have put him in there on Saturday night, not Sunday morning.
Okay.
So that time frame for me doesn't make any sense. That's a minimum of 6 hours missing. So even if you stop for food and gas and that stuff that you just said, it still isn't 6 hours worth.
I can make it 6 hours worth.
No, you couldn't.
I procrastinate. Yep.
But there's no way. How many times do you stop for gas? Every new town?
I'd sit there and fall asleep.
But that's what he said, is that they left 8 a.m. Saturday morning and did not arrive to Missouri the next morning, the next day.
A lot of time unspoken for.
What the hell did you do in those 6 missing hours? Makes no sense. So investigators followed up on his alibi. Turnbill had called the Westport Hotel, where the manager had confirmed that Alan Jackson had stayed at the hotel for one night, November 17th. Okay? But there was no information to where Alan Jacobson had stayed on the night of November 16th. November 16th is the night that his wife and son went missing. According to him, he was on his way to Missouri. But you have an entire 6 hours of time that's not accounted for. He could have done something to his wife and son, drove to Missouri, got there on Sunday, spent the night, and then flew back on the 18th. It's very possible that could have happened. Mm-hmm. Because it's at most 10 hours. And that's if you're stopping for gas and all of that. That's at most. But even with it not adding up, Turnbill wrote in the file that Alan's alibi checked out.
Okay.
Yeah. So on January 7th of 1997, Turnbill had received a letter from a coworker of Alan's, and this letter had stated that Alan and this coworker drove to St. Joseph, Missouri on November 16th, where they stayed the night. Then the two drove to St. Louis, where they spent the evening sightseeing before returning to the hotel for the night. I thought you were on a business trip, sir.
That's what I thought. Isn't that what he said?
That, yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of business trip are you on that you're staying at one hotel in one town, driving to another town, going sightseeing, spending the night, and then going home? What?
I don't know.
Which, mind you, none of my resources states who the sender of this letter is, but I can guarantee it's a woman. So, like I said, the coworker is saying that they spent the night in one place, then drove 4 hours, because I clocked this as well, drove 4 hours to St. Louis, spent the night there, but never said why they went there, what they were exactly doing, why you stopped at one hotel and then continued driving 4 hours just to go see some sights and then fucking come back. It makes no sense. So the questions that arose from Alan's statement and this letter went left unasked and unanswered, because this letter was never followed up on. They got it and it just sat there. So as a result of the initial belief that Sandra and her son had been swept away by the river due to something Sandra had done, their home was never searched. Like, they didn't even try to search her home to get proof of her mental state.
Oh, when was this? What year?
96.
Jesus Christ.
Yep. And then just days later, after they went missing, Sandra's husband, Alan Jacobson, went into the trailer and left with an unknown amount of items. And what these items were couldn't be proved, but according to those that knew the situation and were closest to Sandra, including neighbors, said he took almost everything. Just days after they're missing. Like, you don't even know what happened to him. Her family questioned why the police had allowed him to do this. You want to know the answer they got? Hmm. Well, they're married. And the home and everything inside of it is his property too. Even though she bought it after they separated and he was not living there. Yeah. When Sandra's family asked this yet again about Sandra's purse that was released to Alan on November 27th, and for a third time when he drove Sandra's 1990 Honda Civic off the Bismarck police lot on December 23rd, they were given that exact same answer. They're married, and it's just as much his property as it is hers.
I feel like it was an inside job.
Fucked up. So investigators continued to conduct interviews of those closest to Sandra. While they did this, they continued to search the Missouri River. The North Dakota National Guard was called in multiple times to search from the sky alongside the dive teams that were searching the water. In the spring of 1997, Turnbill made an announcement to boaters to watch out for anything that could point to the whereabouts of Sandra and John, but ultimately, nothing ever came up. On May 20th, 1997, a child's shoe was found near the river in Centennial Park, and investigators believed it could have belonged to John, but John's older brother and grandmother said it was not, because the shoe was too big to fit his little five-year-old foot. Through the years, investigators have continued to receive calls with possible sightings. Each one has been thoroughly investigated, but in the end, each lead and tip result in nothing, most being a case of mistaken identity. On February 23rd, 1999, Turnbill declared the case was inactive, which means they were no longer working on it. It was just sitting there. There was an unconfirmed sighting of Sandra and John in War Road, Minnesota, in June of 2004. This temporarily revived the search for them because before this, the case was cold. Following this revived search effort, local police used newspapers and television networks to inform the Bismarck, Mandan area of their missing persons. Posters with age-progressed images of John were hung all over the state of Minnesota. This was conducted by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Sergeant William Connor was a patrolman for Bismarck Police Department, and he was on the river the night Sandra's car was found.
Your brain's fucking going, I don't know, faster than what your mouth can.
He worked hard that night, even pulling his canine partner into the freezing weather in an attempt to find the missing woman and her son with no results. So this man, he was just a simple patrolman whenever this entire case first started. And now, years later, in 2004, he was brought back to the case when NCMEC reached out to him for help. Once NCMEC got involved with the case, the leads poured in with the last reported tip coming in sometime in February of 2016. A relook at the missing person cases in 2004 revealed key questions that were left unanswered, vital evidence missing, and potential suspects who were cut loose. NCMEC had made several attempts to contact Alan Jacobson to get photos of his wife and son for their missing person flyers and DNA. That way they could create an age-progressed photo of John, but they received nothing from Alan, and so they reached out to Connor for help with this. Initially, Connor was only set out to get DNA from the family members, but he ended up spending years trying to find answers, the answers that the initial investigation failed to find. Sandra's family members were more than willing to provide the DNA and anything else they needed to find these two missing people. In April of 2005, Connor sat down with Alan Jacobson with a long list of questions. When Alan was pressed about his reluctance to cooperate with NCMEC, he said he had in fact sent the photos they had requested, which blew Connor away. Alan stated he had mailed them photos of Sandra and John. He also said yes, he had received the DNA kit, and though he knew this would help find his son, he was not interested in sending in a sample. Why would you not want to send in a sample of your DNA if you know it's going to help find your son?
Could you have something to do with it?
That or you did something else that if you give your DNA is going to tie back to you.
Something else that he did later on, earlier down the road.
Yep.
So, in the past.
So, Alan told Connor that he and Sandra were working on getting back together at the time of their disappearance. He stated they had even went to couples counseling, but said he was the only one who had showed up to the appointment. But none of her friends nor family had made any comments about the two getting back together or going through couples counseling. He's the only one that made any statement about that. I find that very odd. Connor, of course, set out to confirm this claim because this could shed some light on the state of the Jacobsons' relationship at the time of the disappearances. After obtaining a subpoena, Connor had gotten the documents from the employee assistance program that Sandra's work had offered, which covered couples counseling. And Alan claimed that's how they paid for it. But there were no records included in this that there was ever any session that Alan had attended with or without Sandra. Which this was a major red flag for Connor. And for me. Because according to him, they went to couples counseling. But she didn't show up, but he did. But according to the program that paid for it, according to Alan, there are no records of that. Even if Sandra didn't show up, there would still be a record of him showing up. But there's nothing. That doesn't sound right. No. There was still something eating at Connor, though. Why had Alan said that Sandra had an off-the-wall conspiracy theory about him having an affair? What brought this belief on, and why had he used those exact words? So, he went straight to Alan for the answers. This time, Alan had admitted to an affair when they had first split up. And according to him, they had reconciled after that in early 1996. Alan would not admit to any other affairs, even after Connor had informed him that Sandra had told family members about his multiple affairs, and that is why she had moved out of the home they shared. He wouldn't acknowledge that. So those close to Sandra had informed investigators in the week before Sandra and her son had gone missing, there had been a lot of late night phone calls between Sandra and Alan. These calls were so frequent that they had even caused Sandra to go without sleep, and these conversations often left Sandra in tears. So, something is not right there. At all.
Mm-hmm.
So, Connor was unable to obtain those phone records to shed light on who was calling who. That's because it was too late. The original report did contain some phone records for Sandra's home phone, but they were only for the month of October of 1996. And the records that Connor needed were for November. So the original investigators fucked this whole thing up from the very beginning.
Sounds like it.
They believed that she killed herself and her son with no proof or evidence of that, simply because she had mental health issues. They got phone records, but they got the phone records for the month before she went missing, not for the month that she went missing. So Connor went back to try to get them. The records he needed to prove what was going on. Was Sandra calling Alan? Was Alan calling Sandra? What? They were no longer available because it had been too much time. And this was not the only roadblock that Connor would hit in this case. So after not being able to get the records for Sandra's phone, he went after Alan Jacobson's phone records. Alan's cell phone was through Verizon Wireless, and these records only went back as far as 2001. This was the same when they went after Alan's home phone records as well. Connor was, however, able to come across Sandra's car phone records inside the original police file. You remember whenever cars had fucking phones inside of them? You remember, like, it was like that big-ass like block phone. Mm-hmm. It was hooked up in your car. We never had one, but I had friends that had family members that had them. And that was like the coolest fucking thing ever. Now it's like, why do you just have a cell phone? But, you know, that was the thing back then. Just fucking buy a, who needs a cell phone? My car has a phone. So, anyway, in 1996, Turnbill had asked Allen to get these records for the detectives. Surprisingly, he did. While going over the phone logs, Connor had noticed something. In the 2 hours before she disappeared, Sandra had called the same number twice. This number was that of Bismarck United Life Insurance Company. Each call lasted 10 seconds. That 10 seconds was after the phone had been answered, not before. So when these records were first looked at, Allen had told Turnbill, the original detective, oh, this must have been a misdial. I mean, why else would the length of the call be so short, right?
Right.
And of course, Turnbill didn't question this explanation, nor did he follow up with the insurance company about the calls. But Connor would not let it go unexplained. Bismarck United Life Insurance Company had been sold by the time Connor had made his way to them, but thankfully they still had the records that he was looking for. They told Connor that Sandra did have a life insurance policy, that it had been taken out in 1991, but it had overlapsed in 1995. So Connor attempted to track down all the information that he could related to this life insurance policy. It had overlapsed, but who was the beneficiary? Who would get all the money if something happened to her and possibly John? But after 8 years after their disappearance, it was like finding a needle in a haystack. There was no universal database that tracked insurance policies, but there was one road that he could take that may find him answers. He decided to contact Bob Evans, the director of HR at the motor vehicle department where Sandra had worked. Bob had said that Allen had come in a few days following the disappearance and was pretty aggressive about her benefits. The policy was in the amount of $30,000. And Allen was listed as the beneficiary. Allen had openly admitted to getting the payout 5 years following the disappearance of Sandra, claiming that it had been used to cover administrative costs and bills. Which this made sense to Connor. But one thing still didn't sit well with him. Sandra's family members had claimed that Allen had taken many things from Sandra's home just days after she went missing. And he had also been told that she kept a diary and wrote in it religiously. This he needed to find because it would give him a look into the mind of Sandra along with what was happening between her and Allen leading up to her and John's disappearance. If that diary truly existed, Allen would have known about it. If he didn't know about it before, then he would have had to have found it when he cleaned out and sold the trailer that Sandra and her sons lived in. Sandra's family said she wrote in this journal daily and kept detailed notes of her day. It was important for this to be found because it would reveal not only her mental and emotional state, but the relationship with her husband, the relationship with her sons. But what happened to it, and why had they not found it? Allen claimed he didn't know his wife kept a journal. He also claimed he never came across anything that could have been a journal while he was going through and clearing out the house that his son and wife lived in. Not even when he went through it again when he sold it. Which that doesn't make any sense to me. One, how do you not know that your wife keeps a journal? First off, you have a 5-year-old together. Okay, so you've been together for at least 6 years. How would you not know that she has a journal?
I mean, if you don't want something to be found, you won't let it be.
But not only that, he took things from her home just within days of her being missing. Her and his son missing. Then you go into it again and you completely clear everything out when you sell it. And you didn't find anything that could potentially be a journal. Neither time.
Possibly.
I mean, yeah, she could have had it in a dresser, but you would have found it when you cleared it out.
He could behind like a board, a loose board on in the wall or in the closet somewhere. I mean,
I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. It was said that Sandra was looking forward to moving on with her life following the divorce that she believed was in progress, but she did have some anxiety about a possible custody battle. On the night of the disappearance, Sandra's mother said her daughter was visibly upset and very concerned about the potential of a custody battle for her son, John, something a close friend had backed up. Alan, however, had a different story. According to him, he and his wife were trying to work things out.
Shit.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's funny how everybody around her is like she had full belief that they were in the middle of a divorce and it was about to be final. She was ready to move on with her life, but according to him, they were trying to work it out. It doesn't sound right. So the potential for this divorce was important to the investigation. The family estate was in both of their names. So in this divorce, everything, all assets, including land, would be divided up between the two. And had the divorce happened before her disappearance, Sandra's eldest son, who was 16 at the time, would have been included in the conversation about who got what assets. And without the divorce, the spouse, Alan, received everything.
The 16-year-old didn't die, did he?
No.
It was the newborn, or the baby.
The 5-year-old.
Yeah, 5-year-old.
But at that time, whenever it came time for them to divide assets, she's a mother of two. He would have been involved in the conversation on what Sandra got, and some of it would have went to him if the divorce had been final before she went missing. But because there was no divorce before she went missing, Alan got everything. Turnbill had interviewed Sandra's older son in 1996, and in this initial interview, he claimed that he had seen his mother's wedding rings days after she went missing in a change jar on the counter in Alan Jacobson's home. He said he couldn't say for sure that Sandra had been wearing her rings on the day that she was last seen, but he wondered why they would be inside his stepfather's home anyway.
Right. They would be either with her stuff or they would be on
her. They didn't live together, so why would they be in his house? But of course, this was not something Alan had been questioned about until Connor took over the case. Connor asked Alan, and he claimed that he couldn't remember how he had gotten them, but he thought that it was because Sandra had taken them off and left them on the dresser when they had separated, but he couldn't say for sure. All he could say was that he did not take them from the trailer. Didn't nobody suggest that, sir?
Hold on, Phil.
You were just simply asked, how did you get them? Didn't nobody say you took them from the trailer? You fucking jackass. And if you took them, just say, well, they were in the trailer. I found them. I took them because I bought them for her. I didn't want something to happen to them. Like, you get what I'm saying? Like, why fucking lie about it? Unless she wore them and had them on the day she went missing and you took them off of her. He's very suspicious to me.
And forgot that they were in his pocket.
Like, he's very suspicious to me. So without the journals and the memories fading, Connor was running out of options at this point. So he requested Alan take a polygraph test, which would help point him in the direction he needed to go. We all know polygraphs are not admissible in court. They are used as an investigative tool. So by Alan taking one, if he passes it, Connor knows I need to look somewhere else. But if he fails, he knows he needs to dig into Alan a little bit more because something isn't right. So the questions that Alan would be asked would, of course, pertain to the case. A few days later, Connor received a call from Alan's attorney who said Alan would not be taking the polygraph. Not everybody believes you should take a polygraph because they can be unreliable. You can fake results. You can fuck it up. Like, there's a lot of things that come to play with a polygraph. But So I'm not saying he's guilty just based off that, but it, if you decline to do one, it does make you look very suspicious. Mm-hmm. It does not mean you're guilty, but it shines that light of suspicion. And he's already looking suspicious. So that just makes it worse. So the one constant in this case, the one thing that so many people kept going back to, was Sandra's mental state at the time of her and John's disappearance. Her family said she was struggling with her mental health, but they themselves struggled to believe that she would have not only taken her life, but the life of her son as well. She was not even known to raise her voice at her 5-year-old son. So the thought that she could have harmed him was unimaginable. In an effort to make sense of all the allegations Alan had made about Sandra and her beliefs, investigators spoke with those closest to her, including her ex-husband and father to her oldest son, Vernon Nastrom. According to Vernon, in 1996, Sandra had been fascinated with the end of the world. While the two were still together, they had made a pact that if the signs of the end of the world had appeared, they would meet up and jump off the Memorial Bridge together. Memorial Bridge is the bridge that crosses the Missouri River just down the street from Centennial Park. But also, according to Vernon, this pact didn't stick. Sandra's beliefs regarding the end of the world had come and they went. He said through their relationship, she had also held on to the belief that taking one's own life was not the answer, because it meant that your soul would not reach heaven and you would be left to walk the earth forever. So Vernon is like, yeah, we had this pact. She was fascinated by it, but it quickly faded. She held strong to this belief about suicide, and that was it. There's no way. So phone records showed that Sandra had attempted to call Vernon the day that she and John had went missing, just hours before, to be exact. But Vernon claimed that his addiction to crank, a street name for meth, had caused him to miss that phone call because he was high at the time that she had called. So we will never know what she wanted to talk to him about just hours before she and her son went missing. Vernon took a polygraph, to which he passed, and the suspicion on him was gone. Roughly a year later, Vernon would be found dead along a rural road with blunt force trauma to the head being what killed him. His death, too, is still unsolved. Vernon's story of Sandra's obsession with the end of the world matched what Alan had told detectives. It also lined up with what her family told them as well in both 1996 and in 2004. They had also believed that a third party was inside the vehicle with Sandra and John when she called her family distraught, just hours before she vanished. In this call, she had told family members to kill themselves. She then hung up without saying, "I love you," something she had never done before. Alan Jacobson remarried a few years after Sandra and his son went missing. After Sandra's disappearance, her eldest son, Spencer, went on to live with Sandra's mother. Spencer grew up and went on to marry and have 3 daughters of his own. In 2005, like I just said, Spencer's biological father was ran over by his own vehicle and left for dead in a ditch on a maintenance road in Tuttle, North Dakota. He did unfortunately pass away from this incident, and his case still remains unsolved. And the heartbreak for Spencer wasn't over just yet. Tragedy once again struck him. Just 4 years after his father's murder, his wife passed away from a rare form of strep.
Damn. Had a rough freaking childhood, and then damn.
So at 16, he lost his mother and his brother. And then he loses his father. And then his wife. So since their disappearance, the two have been declared legally dead. Should Sandra's body ever be found, dental and fingerprints are on file for comparison. John's DNA has also been uploaded to the national database should he ever be found. The case still remains open today. Both missing person cases are classified as endangered and missing. Sandra Jacobson was 36 years old at the time of her disappearance. If she was still alive, she would be 64 years old today. She was last seen wearing a blue sweatshirt, a blue down-filled jacket, blue jeans, glasses, and brown lace-up boots. She stood between 5'5 and 5'6". She is weighed about 145 pounds. She had brown hair and green eyes with both her ears pierced. John Jacobson was 5 years old, and if he was still alive today, he would be 33 years old. He was last seen wearing a green winter coat with blue cuffs. There are different accounts of his height and weight, with sources reporting that he's around 3 feet tall and weighing about 45 pounds, while others say he was 4'8 and weighed 75 pounds. Which, that doesn't sound right to me, that last one. That's how big Logan is. That's like the height of a 10-year-old.
Yeah, close to it.
Yeah, so he was probably closer to 3 feet, about 45 pounds, but that's what is reported. He had light brown hair and brown eyes. In the decades since the mother and son had vanished, there have been no bodies to show up anywhere. No evidence to prove foul play, and no evidence to prove Sandra herself had harmed herself or her son. There are no suspects in their disappearances. They literally just vanished from existence. In the years following, both Sandra's mother and father have passed away, never having answers to what happened to their daughter or grandson. All of those that loved both Sandra and John still wait for answers to what happened that fateful night in November. There has been a headstone placed in Harmon Cemetery in memory of both Sandra and John, even though their bodies have never been found. So, for those with any information regarding the disappearances, it is asked that you contact the Bismarck Police Department, and you can do that at 701-223-1212. And that is the mysterious disappearance of Sandra and John Jacobson.
That was good.
So, I do have photos that come with the episode. I'm going to post all of those on the Facebook page. That includes the missing person flyers, age progressed photos of John. That link can be found in the episode description. Do you have any final thoughts before we sign off?
Nope, not this one. I don't.
No, that one's sad.
It's crazy that it's still open. Mm-hmm. They haven't found any bodies.
Nope, they literally just vanished. Just gone.
Whoever hit them pretty good, unless they're actually gone somewhere and not, you know, different identities or whatever.
That's what I hope. That's what I hope. I mean, I hate that for her oldest son, but that's what I hope. I hope that she just took off and they just haven't been found. Like, that they're both still alive and she just went off and is living a different life.
But with only one of her kids?
I know.
Crazy, though.
Mm-hmm. It's not plausible because she had two sons and she left one behind, so it's not plausible. But
unless she secretly didn't like that one.
Oh no! It was said. I didn't put it in there, but it was said that she absolutely adored her sons. That her entire world was about her sons. That there's no way she would have harmed a hair on either one of their heads. And that was listed in every source that I have. So that's what I hope, is that maybe she just ran off with him. Maybe she felt that he was in danger or something. I don't know. It's not plausible, but that's what I'm going to hold on to. Just because it's already a sad story to begin with. So, all right. Well, you don't have anything else. All right, we'll be back on Thursday for a spooky episode. We hope you keep listening and remember to
watch for monsters.
And don't kill people.
Bye.
Bye, y'all.
Please be sure to rate and review so we can make sure we give y'all a podcast you love. Be sure to subscribe so you get notifications each week when episodes air.
If you want to send us a case or a topic suggestion, you can email us at monstroustcpod@gmail.com.
Also, be sure to check out our Facebook page for updates along with information and photos for each week's episodes.